Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Manchester Is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Railston. I'm your host today and we're recording on a Monday afternoon after a week of not much really happening in the world of Manchester and Gordon United. Isn't that right, Samuel? You were off, should we say, for 2 weeks, quote unquote, but you weren't really off.
No, off and on, unfortunately, given that it was the worst 2 weeks in living memory to take off. But that's, you know, people might see it as the pitfalls of the job, but we all know what we're getting into. So it's I did try and avoid getting involved in certain things because there was a dedicated and dependable team, members such as yourself and Ty on call. But then, unfortunately, contacts start messaging you certain things and you check them out. And one thing leads to another and you think, no, this isn't going to hold. This is going to have to be given to the desk. So it's a window into, you know, the pitfalls of journalism. But nevertheless, it's an occupational hazard. We all know that we're getting ourselves into from the outset.
And another member of that dedicated team, my esteemed colleague, Tyrone Marshall. Tyrone, how are you today?
Good. Thank you, Stephen. Good. Yes, looking forward to taking next week off when I believe Erik ten Hag is going to resign. So yeah, I'm going to have my feet up then.
That's
a joke, by the way, for any listeners before it ends up on an aggregator account or something like that.
Exclusive. They have big decisions around this time, yeah, don't they? Solskjaer, Mourinho.
Yeah,
but I think Ten Hag is definitely safe now. Definitely safe. Samuel, we'll just get straight into it. Obviously, you were off when the news broke on Tuesday night that the Glazers were looking or exploring strategic alternatives for the club. Obviously, a seismic announcement, absolutely huge news. It comes after the Ronaldo news that kind of dwarfed it, didn't it? So what was your snap verdict really when you saw that sitting in your house on your day off thinking, bloody hell, this is big?
Yeah, I had my laptop open because Ronaldo had happened and I'd got in. But fortunately, as I said, you guys and whoever was on, Ty was on at that time and others staying on, had done a bang up job of that. There was nothing really more to do. And certainly as far as opinion was concerned, I think I'd said my piece on Ronaldo and everyone else had as well. And fortunately, in some ways, especially for those of you who were working properly last week, the news cycle moved on incredibly quickly with Mark Kleiman's exclusive, the Sky News business journalist. And I think when those stories emerge and they are sourced and reported by a business journalist, you know immediately there's no doubting the credibility of it. It's completely believable, and obviously it was confirmed within hours. It wasn't really as seismic as you say and significant as it was. It wasn't really a surprise because we've spoken about it previously this year or this season even, that just looking at United's revenues and their cash flow, the Glazers were going to need added investment sooner or later. And so, as I said, the news wasn't particularly surprising in that sense because they were going to have to take that decision at some point, even though I suppose a lot of United supporters would thought, well, it's been 17 and a half years, what's going to change things now? But clearly what's piqued their interest has been the sale of Chelsea this year and the amount that costs as well for Todd Burley and I think is it Clearwater Lake or something like that that the consortium's called. Yeah, thank you. So there's obviously that's happened, and then of course Liverpool were put up for sale as well. And now simultaneously, you've got the two biggest clubs in Britain and two of the biggest clubs in the world in, by far and away, the biggest and most attractive league in the world for sale. And so it would have been, I suppose, remiss of the Glazers not to have tried to turn the heads of investors who are looking potentially at buying Liverpool or investing in Liverpool when they might actually think, do you know what, we would rather invest in Man United, and because there's the argument to be made that United are a bigger club than Liverpool. So I think from the Glazers' viewpoint, it's a logical strategy. And you know, hearing someone as authoritative and as time-served United supporters, Michael Crick last week, discussing it, you know, you still have to preach caution, as Giddy's supporters were at the prospect of the Glazers occupation finally ending. It might not necessarily be a straight sale. I think there's going to have to be a bit of time for people to take over it. Essentially, it does feel like a transfer window already. You saw last week, we wrote stories. Ty spoke to Jim O'Neill, who a lot of United fans will remember from the Red Knights attempt in 2010. The owner of Zara, he's expressed interest. Apple have been mentioned as well. When United are valued at $5 billion or $6 billion, whatever it is, there are only a small pool of very affluent people who can really afford them. And that is going to attract, you know, some rather unpalatable potential owners. And that was another thing that Crick stated last week that was important, and also echoed by the Must statement, which was the importance of who the owners are. United supporters are one of the most principled there are out there. And I'm not saying this as a dig at Newcastle or anything like that, or Manchester City fans, but you've always got the feeling that United fans, proper United fans, paying supporters, matchgoers, would absolutely abhor the prospect of, you know, some sheikh coming in or an oligarch. I don't think an oligarch could do that these days after what happened with Roman Abramovich earlier this year and the war in Ukraine. But there are certain owners out there who've got their grubby or bloodied hands on football clubs. And it's, you know, hopefully, if there is a positive from the Ukraine war, which feels like a strange statement to make, but it's a minor one in terms of it being related to football. But you'd think that there are more thorough checks as to who the owners could be. But where there's still no independent football regulator, and with the current government really not inclined to install one anytime soon, despite that review that was led by Tracy Crouch and published earlier this year, I'm not certainly holding out any hope that there's going to be one introduced before the next general election, which is still, what, 2 years away, 18 months away. Labour have already said that they want to, they would introduce one. But again, that's possibly 2 years away at the very least. So it's reassuring that a lot of United supporters have already stressed that they are going to attract some pretty unseemly characters, and maybe some shady characters who I'm sure a quick Google check will tell you quite a lot about their character. So I think it's in United's interests, and look, whether the Glazers care about that or not, I suspect they don't. I suspect they'll just take however much money they can get. If they can, you know, whip up an auction of some sort, then great for them. But you do hope, for United's sake, that if it does come to a straight sale, that it's one that's palatable, that it's one that that is certainly not of the kind that we've seen at other clubs in the last 15 or 20 years. And there's a reason why many United supporters, the majority of United supporters, identify to Jim Ratcliffe as the saviour, because probably the worst thing he's done is really is dodge taxes by, you know, he's a UK citizen, but he lives in Monaco. That's as bad as it gets, apparently. So I think United fans are more than happy to stomach that. And he has already said that if he were to run a football club, it would be as a community asset. And for someone who was born in Fallowfield, coming back to Manchester to try and make his boyhood club a force again, that's probably the closest you're going to get to one of these throwback chairmen who used to be the local butcher and then had the money to take over their local football club and transform it. Those days are pretty much well and truly over. But I suppose Ratcliffe is the deluxe version of it.
We'll come on to that a bit in a second then, because it is important to discuss potential new owners and who they are, obviously. But Ty, when the news came through, obviously Samuel said it's probably not a surprise, and he's just laid out the reasons why it is a logical time for them to sell the club, because of course it is. However, do we really think that they want to sell it completely, or perhaps are they looking for a minority investor? Because there was a suggestion, I think, in August that they were in talks with it was a US equity firm that were potentially looking at a minority stake. So is it a permanent deal you think we're looking at here, or maybe a minority stake?
I think if it was a minority stake, it would have happened by now. I don't think you put that statement out and basically say you're open to a full sale when you're looking for a minority stake. I don't think it gets that far when the minority stake is the top target. And I don't think anyone's going to go for a minority stake now they know they're open to selling. If they were looking for a minority stake, then like I say, I think you had those reports in August that they've probably been looking for that for 3 or 4 months and just can't get it, which is why they've put this statement out that they're open to a full sale now. I think it'd be a surprise if you reach this sort of position and row back from selling the club now. I think once you're out there that the club is on the market, it's going to be on the market. And I think I don't think it's any coincidence that Liverpool and United are on the market at the same time. Like Samuel said, the Chelsea fee raised a lot of eyebrows in the Premier League, especially with American-owned clubs, that Chelsea could be that valuable when they were essentially being listed on eBay, a forced sale through the government. There was no, that was a club that had to be sold and had to be sold quickly. It still had 200 odd people interested. You had a consortium willing to pay $2.5 billion plus another $1.75 billion in infrastructure costs. That's more than £4 billion to pay for a club that were being auctioned off, basically. And I think the value of Chelsea caught a lot of people by surprise. And the thing with the Glazers and FSG is that they've had two attempts in the last 2 or 3 years to really monetize their business, which is Project Big Picture in the European Super League. Both have failed. It's hard to see in the short term how either get off the ground again. And if they're thinking of cashing out in the next 2, 3, 4 years, I can't see a Super League happening in that period of time. So I think this is probably as valuable as clubs are going to get. And when you look at the amount of interest in Chelsea, they probably feel that they could still get a good price and a good buyer now. You wait another 2 years, maybe the picture will change. So I think it just shows that it's the optimum time for people like that who've owned the Glazers for 17 years. FSG must have had Liverpool for 10, 12, something like that. So they've been around a long time. They're both going to make astronomical profits. And I don't think that the Chelsea thing raised attentions, I think, in terms of club values. But I think the real reasoning here why they're doing it is they've seen that. And they also know that their attempts to push revenues into stratospheric levels or levels where it be unaffected by things like not finishing the top four have fallen apart because of the ESL, and there's no other way to kind of lock those revenues in now. So there's no other way in the next couple of years, I don't think, to drive the business up, which is why it probably makes sense for them both to look to sell now.
To expand on your previous point then, Samuel, who would be the ideal candidates to take the club forward, to take over from the Glazers? You've discussed, obviously, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, who has been this figure supporters have looked to in the protests and have kind of held him up. You've discussed his links to Manchester, obviously. Do you think he would be an ideal candidate among the list? And I've saw Saudi Arabia, their sports minister, has come out and said they would support investment from the private sector. You've just discussed kind of the morality of the issue. So could you expand on that a bit more, please, and kind of who do you think would be the perfect owners? I know it is very early at this stage still.
Yeah, I think with the Saudi element, that I do find that unsettling. And I wrote that 3 or 4 years ago, just as a point of principle, really, just to kind of establish that. And look, I think when you look at the takeover that's gone on at City and the success they've had, the training ground they've got, the way they're structured as a club, they are one of the best run football clubs in the world. And really they've gone out there, they've recruited the best around, whether it be Chicky Beggiristein as a football director or technical director, whatever his title is, and Ferran Soriano above him. And of course, Guardiola has been the coach of the century. They have gone for best in class, and that's mirrored also on the pitch as well. So Manchester City fans bound to be absolutely thrilled with the last 14 years under the Abu Dhabi ownership. But when you scratch the surface, and it's not a case of doing digging as such, but you actually read some of the things about how it was Nick McGeoghegan's piece about 5 years ago, which is still recommended. And rather than just try and remember what he wrote, I'd rather say to people, go out and read that piece. I mean, the intro to it is if you're not sat upright reading the intro, then there's no point reading beyond that, because it really is a jolt, the comparison, if you like. I think the intro kind of reflects on the upcoming Amazon documentary, and it spices together what I think the brother of Sheikh Mansour was once filmed doing in a desert, which I think it's probably best I don't go into in any more details of that. But I think it would be unpalatable for Manchester, for its two footballing institutions, to be owned by states. And there's been a lot of money ploughed into Manchester by the Abu Dhabi group. There's been money that's come in from China. I think it was only about 6 or 7 years ago that President Xi was having a selfie with Sergio Aguero at City's training ground. We talk about things that don't age well, and that's one of them. When you see, you know, the issues that people have encountered, that the world's encountered with China in recent years, and again, what's going on there at the moment, there seems to be the biggest uprising since Tiananmen Square. So the geopolitical side of it is something that you can't really ignore. But going back to the Saudi aspect, it's one name that you think of, which is Khashoggi, Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who was, you know, butchered to death in the Saudi Arabian embassy in Istanbul at the behest of the ruler of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. I don't want anyone like that being associated with any football club, never mind Manchester United. It's just a point of principle. And we can get into the morality of other countries, and I can imagine people listen to this and they're thinking, well, United are owned by Americans, and America embarked on an illegal war in 2003. And of course it did. And there's probably not a single country out there that isn't tainted or doesn't have or isn't whiter than white. But there are certain, lines that you just cannot cross. And the whole thing with Khashoggi is so current, and it really does make your blood run cold when the opening ceremony of the FIFA World Cup, you've got Bin Salman sat next to the FIFA president, who he was also sat next to for the opening game at the 2018 World Cup. I don't want to get into Infantino. I mean, the guy's a waste of time. But getting back to the ownership point, that's why it's important for United supporters, matchgoers, to value integrity. And as I said, I'm pretty sure they do. And Michael Crick outlined that perfectly last week. And that was echoed by Mus, and it was echoed by a lot of other time-served paying supporters online as well. I think they are very mindful of that, and that the appearance of it is vital, which is why the majority of them have latched on to Ratcliffe, because he has got that connection there, in that he's from the area. He grew up in Manchester. He is a United fan. He was in Camp Nou in 99. And when he did make an offer for Chelsea earlier this year, the deadline had passed, but the offer was still made. Now, someone as affluent as Jim Ratcliffe is not going to do that unless there's a purpose to it. And it felt at the time that he was laying down a marker. And he's gone on the record number of times talking about the potential, potentially buying United, and why it's not been viable or not possible at that time. So, look, when I tried to check in with them last week, there was no comment. The week before, just in response to the Ronaldo comments on the Glazers, it was like, oh, nothing's changed. So I can't imagine he wouldn't be weighing up the potentially buying United, and he certainly wouldn't be a minority stakeholder with the Glazers. Someone with Ratcliffe's profile, he would be majority stakeholder. So he would be, I can understand why United fans see him as panacea, because beyond that, he has got cachet in other sports. Where the marathon runner, I forget his name, but he bankrolled his record when he did the marathon in under 2 hours a few years ago, I think it was. He's invested in Ben Ainsley trying to win the America's Cup in sailing. Nice came close to qualifying for the Champions League in Liga last year as well. Obviously, he's invested in cycling as well. Team Sky, I think, have been renamed the Ineos Grenadiers. And so he's tapping into Sir Dave Brailsford, who, look, you know, it's a pretty questionable figure as well if you look at Team Sky's history and the therapeutic use exemptions. But he's someone who is highly regarded in the sporting world, and Ratcliffe's got him involved in football now with Nice. So he's clearly an innovative thinker, and he looks best in class as well. And he's driven, despite all his wealth. There's that drive there. And trying to make United a force again, trying to make them champions again, would obviously trump any other achievement he he has in life, pretty much. I think for all the billions his petrochemicals empire has made, if he were to take over United and make them champions for the first time in 15 years or however long it may be, that's what he would be remembered for. And it would make it a great story, albeit on a, you know, extremely deluxe level, that here's a guy from Fallowfield who went back to Manchester in his 70s and made Man United champions again, or helped them become champions again. So that would be the romantic element to it. But I suppose with a lot of these things, as romantic as they may seem, and yes, certainly for Manchester City fans, with Aguero's goal in 2012, it's one of the most remarkable moments in English football. But their success is only down to the fact that they were bought out by a state, and they tend to blow every competition out of the water. And that success is a little bit like Chelsea's. It's rendered rather hollow.
I tell you what, I ran a half marathon in September. There was no backing for us at gym. What was he thinking? I might just give him page up and everything. I promoted that quite well on Twitter.
It'd have been a good sponsor. Yeah, he would have. Yeah, he would have really.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Time for analyse the deal a bit closer. I ask you about the stumbling blocks and all the potential stumbling blocks for any deal. You've mentioned obviously the competition at Liverpool, they're on the market. What else do you think could be the stumbling blocks, really? Could it be the Glazers themselves? Obviously, there's been talk of their asking price, and we've saw Chelsea, their kind of value that they went for, but there's been talk of the Glazers valuing United well above that.
Yeah, definitely. The asking price and the Glazers themselves is an issue. From what you hear, not all the siblings are maybe singing off the same page in terms of wanting to sell the club. So that could be a potential issue. And just this talk of £5 billion, £6 billion, I mean, maybe they get it given the interest. It just sounds astronomical. I mean, this is going back a bit to who buys it, but No good can come from a football club being sold for £5 or £6 billion. I don't think so, unless someone like Jim Ratcliffe is buying it. But, you know, there are very few Manchester-born billionaires with that sort of money. In fact, there's probably only one, and that's to Jim Ratcliffe. Beyond that, you know, if you're selling it for that sort of thing, it's going to American private equity, then you can't say better the devil you know, with the Glazers. But after 17 years, but an American private equity firm would not think twice about fleecing the profit to Euro European Super League or something like that. But yeah, in terms of stumbling blocks, I think the Glazers themselves and what their demands might be are a potential one. I think there'll be enough interest to get a deal done. I think there'll be someone mad enough to pay what they want or give them close to what they want. And if they've, whatever the disagreements may be within the family, if they've reached this position where they're putting out a public statement, they probably know that the writing is on the wall. And then I think beyond that, one of the interesting aspects of it is the fact that this comes at a point when they've got architects and master planners working on Old Trafford and Carrington, and significant money to be invested there. I mean, if the club was sold outright for, say, £5 billion, a new owner's going to have to put at least £1 billion probably into the stadium. And I think there's
£2 billion with rising costs.
Possibly £2 billion. Yeah, well, that's right. And costs, we know, building costs are shooting up. Just what's happening in the world at the moment. So that's a huge investment, and that is going to be an issue. I did a piece over the weekend with Kieran Maguire, a lot of people might know, who's a pretty renowned football finance expert, and he was talking about the idea that a new owner, if they're in it for the long term, might kind of see the benefits of just building a new Old Trafford that is the best stadium in the world, 90,000 seaters, the best corporate facilities in the world. And the extra money that would make compared to the current Old Trafford would probably pay for itself. But you're talking 15, 20-year ownership for that sort of money to come to fruition. But maybe someone sees the long-term game in that. But I think once you're at this level, you'd think there's going to be a sale. And I think it's the Glazer, especially Joel Glazer, is, as much as he's a detached owner in terms of going to games, I think he probably knows the mood around the club and what fans think of him. I'm sure he gets told on fans' forums and picks up the general message of what's going on. And if they were to come out with a statement and then in 6 months say, we've not had anything, that we've not had an offer that suits us, I think they know that that would be considered pretty unacceptable by United fans. And if they think the protests are bad now, they'll probably go up a level even then. So I think we're probably at the point where this is the beginning of the end for them, where a sale will happen. But I guess if you're in a position where you need all family members to agree, I don't know if that's the case or not, to be entirely honest, I don't know how the shareholding breaks down, but then there's obviously potential for disagreements going forward, I guess.
In terms of the to-do list then, Samuel, if new owners do come in, if we try and whittle it down to the three most pressing matters, if you can, is it the Old Trafford redevelopment, as Ty's just said? Is it obviously first team investment? Is it Carrington? Or is it changing the calling on the concourses to Peroni? What's the most pressing priorities for the new owners?
Very good, very good. I think Peroni would be quite high up on certain people's lists there, or maybe something else. Old Trafford is a huge project that I think United need to really. It's been a while since there's been a real tangible update from them, and you don't obviously rush these things, but it is interesting that from what I've been told, that the discussions that have been had behind the scenes and what they've weighed up and whether they would knock it down and build a new one or enhance it, but you know, already these mini projects, just looking into it, are quite advanced in terms of what the cost would be, how long it would take, what the power broker's preference would be. And Joel Glazer's, you know, has been opinionated on that. He's given his opinion. Obviously, if he's checking out now or doesn't want to be co-chairman or owner of Manchester United anymore, then what happens with that? You know, I still think that they're not going to just leave Old Trafford to be in the state that it's in at the moment. That is going to have to be addressed, whether it's under the Glazer family or under new ownership. And as Ty said, when you weigh up the cost of it, I mean, the way the Chelsea transaction was done in the end, I think there was an upfront fee. It's like a transfer fee, really. Upfront fee of something like 2.75 billion. And then there was a dedicated 2.25 billion, I think, to be paid over 10 years. Now, that would be the way to do it, in that this 2 billion that you promised to pay over 10 years, you say that is for the stadium and the stadium only. And then, okay, it's like £200 million a year on the stadium. But as I said, with the cost of Old Trafford, if you are to do a new stadium, I think the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, in the end, that cost £1 billion. That was completed in 2019, so it's pre-pandemic. When you take into account the cost of living, prices going up, it probably would be nearer £2 billion. Tools and materials for builders to do their jobs, they're just going up all the time as well. Brexit's happened as well. That's had an impact on cost. So I think that for a potential owner, that would be the best way to do it. You say this is a 10-year project, and that's been the suggestion, that it would be a 10-year project if you were to do a new stadium, because you would need, it would be a couple of years, maybe 3 years, just cutting through all the red tape, going to council meetings, speaking to residents in the area, gaining planning permission. How would you go about doing it? The suggestion to me is that the cost between doing a new stadium and enhancing Old Trafford is actually quite similar, which I was surprised by. I think the incentive to do a new stadium is that, the suggestion to me has been that would actually be a quicker process than enhancing Old Trafford. The suggestion is that enhancing Old Trafford would be a 10-year project, which I was taken aback by, in that, okay, you work stand by stand, but surely you could do it a bit quicker than that. But with the planning process and, as I said, cutting through all the red tape, apparently not. So it's interesting that obviously they've looked into these things in great detail, and I think a new Old Trafford, the word is that, you know, they can have it as big as they want. That would appeal to them. One of the ideas floated is that if there was to be a new Old Trafford, the second tier, or even the existing Old Trafford, is that the second tier would just be a bit like at Wembley. That's your hospitality section. And then you maximise hospitality. You get more revenue in that way. They would look to build another tier on the Stretford end and the scoreboard end as well. They could address the roof because although they say the acoustics are actually better than people say they are at Old Trafford, that angular shape to it is not conducive to it. And it's clearly, you look at the architectural designs of stadiums now, most of them are oval. So there's got to be something to that. So that means an entirely new roof. So the more you think about it, it is a real, you know, it would take the best part of a decade, maybe as long as a decade. And look, again, from an owner's perspective, although you would be ploughing a hell of a lot of money into that, you would also, you know, be trumpeted as the person who has overseen the redevelopment or the rebuild of Old Trafford. I think that if they were to completely rebuild it, it would be on that site. The suggestion has been, again, from what I was told, was that it would maximise the space behind the Stretford end, where you've got this vast car park, which really, you know, you look at it and you think, look, this is a waste, really. Rather than have a big car park there, you could be doing more with it there, just as a site, never mind the stadium. And so I've always thought that that would be the best way forward. Do what Tottenham did. You knock down the old stadium and you build a new one. Not what a throw in away. It's not that far away at all. But again, that's, you know, we're rambling on about it, or I'm rambling on about the stadium. And that's completely, it's not completely separate to obviously a takeover, but it's such a huge part of it. And financing that, as Ty touched upon, it's just such a huge project that if a stadium's going to cost $2 billion, then you've got the separate value of Manchester United. And you're already talking about $5 billion. Now, is anyone going to commit $7 billion at the moment? I know, you know, some people might think, you know, that's worth a pump, but it was interesting reading Lord O'Neill's interview with Ty last week, where he thought that Chelsea were massively their fee was, you know, inflated, and Ratcliffe has pretty much said the same thing as well. So these, you know, these very affluent people, these billionaires who are having a look at football clubs, but then they're thinking twice because they think they're overpriced, is an interesting subplot to it, which could mean that, you know, it drags out the process longer than people might hope it would be.
Ty, I think it was around 4 hours before the Glazers' announcement that the small matter of Cristiano Ronaldo's future was decided, when we were obviously online together. By mutual consent, I think around 5 days after his interview, the second part of his interview with Piers Morgan, obviously he said he doesn't respect Ten Hag, he made other extraordinary claims. It was inevitable that was going to be the ending, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I don't think that was surprising to anyone. I think that from the day after the interview, and you got the impression that United, you know, through the statement they released, said very little, but it said enough to make you think that this was the route they were going down, just in the way it was phrased and the terminology they used. And yeah, it was, you know, from the moment after that, it was inevitable, really. There was never going to be any way back. Not just that, you know, the criticism and the implied criticism of Ten Hag, the general criticism of the club, even to his own players. You know, when he's asked which players he admires, and he can essentially name three teammates that he admires, I mean, there's no way back in the dressing room for him after that. So yeah, it was, you know, it was always going to be game over. And obviously it was mutual agreement without him receiving another penny in wages. Yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder if this was really necessary at all. I'm sure if he'd have asked to go in January and come up with a club that wanted him, United would have let him go, because it's been pretty clear for a long time that it's just not working. And United, I don't think, are too fussed about carrying his wages. Ten Hag doesn't see him as someone who fits in, A, to his style, and B, to his off-pitch philosophy, really, in terms of team spirit and things like that, given the misdemeanours we've seen already. So, you know, you think that interview was pretty pointless, really, and just the choice as well. I don't know if anyone's seen, but since we've been on, Piers Morgan's tweeted another football exclusive that he's got tonight. with Richard Keys and Andy Gray. So it kind of shows the level that Ronaldo's at, you know, and his football interviews are Ronaldo and Keys and Gray spinning their narrative, and I'm sure they'll get a soft drive from him as well. I mean, you can just imagine the golf competition, can't you? Morgan, Ronaldo, Trump, Keys and Gray. It's a five ball and no one wants that.
The dinner party,
so, yeah. It's some dinner party, isn't it? I mean, you wouldn't get a word. They'd all be
talking about it, wouldn't they?
No one would get a word in edgeways. Yeah, you can imagine Piers Morgan going over being asked, so what did the rest say? I don't know. I just talked over them. It, you know, that'd be painful. So yeah, it was inevitable. It's for the best now, but it just seems completely unnecessary. And I'm sure in time his legacy, a bit of a dreadful word, but I'm sure he'll be remembered for the greatness he brought in those first 6 years. The return has clearly not worked out in any way, shape or form, really. And it just seems a pointless and unnecessary way for it to end, really, when I'm sure he could have left on a free transfer in January if a club wanted him. That's what he's got, essentially. I'm sure United would have happily let that happen, really, if a club would have wanted him. So it just seems an unnecessary way to go about burning your bridges, really, but there we are.
Ronaldo's left the building, Samuel, and obviously that means Martial's the only recognised centre forward at the club. He's been injured a lot of times this season. His record leaves a lot to be desired in that regard. Rashford scored 8 goals. He's been in form, we know that, but he's better on the left. He's not a centre forward. You've wrote the line that the club would obviously be open to signing a striker in January. So can you tell us a bit more about that? And it would be negligence not to sign a striker in January, wouldn't it? They simply have to sign a forward.
I'm sorry to break the news to you, Stephen, but they are going to try and get Chris Wood from Newcastle. Short-term battering ram, Premier League proven goal scorer to get them into the top four.
20 goals he'd get you. 20 goals, I'd say.
Yeah. Well, I was told this morning that already Choupo-Moting has been linked to United, which is, I mean, given Odion Ighalo a few years ago, that is somewhat believable, and he does, I suppose, fit that profile of short-term Premier League experience. I hesitate to say goal scorer because I really don't think he scores many goals, but he serves a purpose for Bayern Munich because the Bundesliga is a relatively, it's an easier league to operate in. And if you're a backup striker as well, it's not really as much of an issue as if you're a backup striker in the Premier League, where you've really got to be on your toes whenever you come into a game, whenever you start a game. And it's a lot easier to expose a striker at that level as well. So I'd be worried if United did go down the Choupo-Moting route. I mean, if they'd actually floated Marko Arnautovic as a suggestion now, I don't think they'd have had as much of a backlash as they did in the summer, when the backlash was pretty fierce, and they got both barrels during that period, and rightly so, because the timing of that was ridiculous, given that it was a squad rebuild, it was a summer transfer window, and there they were seriously considering actually bidding for Arnautovic. But it is that kind of profile they need to really look for, because I would be very, very, I'd also be worried if they just said, let's just give PSV Eindhoven £30 million for Cody Gakpo, who obviously was a player that was under consideration briefly by United in the summer. But as Dutch-centric as their transfer window was, the weakest outfield player has been the only Dutchman in Malaysia. And with Martinez, the South American character has been crucial there. Ericsson, yeah, you know, he played for Ajax, but he's been a class player in the Premier League. Antony is similarly to Martinez, although he's not hit the heights of Martinez, he's got the requisite character to have an impact at United. Malacia is the only one who struggled. And looking at this Dutch team, I mean, Louis van Gaal is trying to turn the clocks back to 2014, but they do not have a forward fit to lace the boots of Robin van Persie or Arjen Robin or Wesley Sneijder. That's what made them a really good side back in 2014. That's why they went deep in that tournament. It was because they had some terrific forwards, but it was a very methodical Dutch side, and you know, van Gaal made the most of it. This Dutch team, you know, I think they've lost momentum since Koeman left for Barcelona a couple of years ago. And Van Gaal's done a very good job. I think they're still unbeaten under him. But Vincent Janssen started their first game, and you know, Gakpo has got a couple of goals. He's having a good World Cup. But the timing of the World Cup is obviously a red flag as well, because the last thing you want to be doing is spending a substantial amount of money on someone who has played well at the World Cup. And you can imagine United, you know, kind of looking at Gakpo. But as I said, they have, if they were to actually sign him in January, they would say he was under consideration in the summer. This is not a knee-jerk reaction to his performances at the World Cup. But I think they need to think a little bit more outside the box. And I don't mean go to the Chinese Super League and see what Premier League cast-offs are just, you know, got their feet up there and making them out to be a bit of a competition winner or anything like that. But they are going to need someone, because there were fundamental issues with that attack before Ronaldo left. I think we've said all season, really, that the attack is light, and that's with six or seven forwards. For 1 month, I suppose, it bumped up to seven because Garnacho came in the team and has done brilliantly, and he's established himself as a first-team squad member now. But with Ronaldo gone, although he's passed it, frankly, and he's been more of a hindrance than a help for United when he was playing for them this season, at least with him, you did have some presence, and there was a fear factor still, albeit a flagging fear factor. But with him gone, they absolutely do not have a dependable goal scorer in that team. And you can't really take that risk. And I'm not saying that whoever they're getting in January is going to be an outright, you know, a guy who's going to come in and is going to be scoring goals week in, week out. But they do need to get someone in, because look, Champions League football is on the line for them. I don't think any of us really predicted at the start of the season they'd finish in the top four. They have improved since then, but they are still fifth. You know, there are ways of looking at it as glass half empty, glass half full. I think they've had a reasonably progressive few months so far this season, but they are taking chances if they don't do anything with the attack. And I've been told that they essentially, the quote that was used to me was that they can hit the button and solutions will present themselves, in that they can compile a shortlist immediately of attainable mid-season forwards who fit the bill and fit what the Ten Hag's profile of a forward to bring in January. Who that is still remains to be seen, but they are going to have to be active. And look, they've had advance notice as well, because Ronaldo was, you know, I mean, probably the best thing he's done for them this season in some ways was do that interview, because it allowed them to get rid of someone who was becoming a nuisance, really, who was becoming a problem. And they can, you know, they can now, they've got what, 6 weeks or whatever it may be before the January window opens. So that is going to increase expectation from supporters that something immediate has to happen early in January. And they have done that before. I mean, he was extremely overrated, and he was not very good, even though it did seem like a very good signing at the time. But Henrik Larsson, when he did join on loan, that was announced, I think, in mid-December, because the Swedish league had, that season had ended, so he was on his three month break until the new season. So they were able to arrange that very, very quickly, and they need something lined up as soon as possible, because when the domestic season, when the club season restarts, the games are going to come thick and fast. And if United are to advance in competitions, January promises to be an extremely busy month. And in February, they've not got the two free midweeks, because they've got Barcelona in the knockout ties.
In reality, John Murtagh's going to click that transfer button, and Agallo is going to appear, isn't he? For his return, his fairy tale return.
I think he's playing in Saudi Arabia now.
He's still going strong. What about Nicholas? It's got Nicholas Fulkrug written all over it, hasn't it?
Well,
impressive.
Not a bad shout, actually. Yeah. Took his goal very well.
He did. Hell of a hit.
Ty, if we stay just to end the podcast, I'm conscious of time. I wanted to ask you about Rashford in England. I'll not ask Samuel about England, because that's later earlier. Obviously, England play Wales tomorrow night. We're recording on the Monday. Southgate's brought him on both games, but he's played on the right side, which I thought is quite unusual. I'd actually start him against Wales. Could you see him starting?
Yeah, I'd start him. I'd start him on the left. He took his goal on from the right pretty well in the first game. I was surprised he played on the right. No, it was the first game when him and Foden came on. They both played on their natural sides, didn't they? I mean, the problem is you've seen this at United as well. There's just with the trend for inverted wingers these days, there's just far more left-sided attackers than there is right because there's so few left-footers out there, and you know they're a lot more. Their scarcity value is a lot higher than left-siders. You look at the number of potential left-sided options United have got, and then you end up with Alanga or Rashford or Fernandes shoved onto the right to make up the numbers, basically. So yeah, I would start him tomorrow night. I think he's deserving of a start off the left, and he's looked pretty sharp in what he's done so far, and I think United really need to get that contract sorted out, don't they?
Oh, that was fantastic.
Stephen Ralston's emergency contract. Stephen would be, he could be sat on the beach or passing Ibiza, and if the news dropped, he would rush out and say, "Do you know what? I've got to do a Marcus Rashford emergency contract."
I'd abandon a pint of Peroni for a Rashford statement, of course. Thank you very much, Samuel. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Stephen.
And thank you, Tyrone.
Thanks, Stephen.
And thanks to the team. Take care.